I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. In the wreckage of the explosive ISIS attack in Paris, there lies not least the wishful thinking that the Sunni warriors running rampant in much of Iraq and Syria were a force contained by geography, or that they were deluded about their potency, as President Obama misestimated. He had compared them last year to a JV basketball team that put on LA Lakers uniforms and imagined, as he said, they were Kobe Bryant. As all the world absorbs the fresh tragedy of Islamist terror in the cultural heart of Europe, we're taking fresh instruction for most of this radio hour from a man of uncommon respect, the career Foreign Service officer Charles, known as Chaz Freeman, speaking plainly from a long and studious lifetime in diplomacy, strategy, and intelligence. First, just to get our bearings in the new context of apprehension, we asked citizens on their way through Boston Common this week what they thought is to be done.
We had 9/11, you had the marathon bombings, Paris has had all of these atrocities, and the common thread is radical Islam. They want territory, and they want a worldwide caliphate, and everybody that doesn't like them is in their way.
Reading an article this morning in the paper saying that maybe the best thing to do is nothing and let ISIS and destroy itself, but that's hard to do when you're sitting around watching innocent people die.
I think the U.S. and friends should be building a wall to seclude ISIS from getting anywhere into other countries.
Another thing, too, that needs to be done is to stop the oil money that has been financing ISIS. And we shouldn't be derailed by these sudden ideas about bombing the hell out of them.
I think we should start bombing heavily. It's going to be difficult, but that's the only way we're going to do is to wipe them out.
There are candidates in both parties who are ready to pour tons and tons of more taxpayer dollars into the military and send more and more people out to die. So we don't want another Iraq war. Cautious in how we approach it.
Oh, I don't think we should continue fighting. I mean, I don't think that violence is the answer. But I do think that we need to, I guess, up our security a little bit.
They're going to have to resolve that refugee problem. Sadly, I think they need to send some of them back. But I'm in favor of the Christians coming over. It's just the other people. I just don't know who's good and who's bad.
Being scared isn't going to help. The reality is, I think throughout time, there have been extremists and radicals. And we sort of have to live with it. We do what we can, keep our citizens safe, and that's about it.
Our guest and guide to the world after ISIS hit Paris had a legendary career in the U.S. Foreign Service. Chaz Freeman did the live translating of the breakthrough U.S.-China talks in the early 1970s when he was still in his 20s. Fluent in Mandarin, also in Arabic, he rose to be George H.W. Bush's ambassador to Saudi Arabia during the first Gulf War in the 1990s. It has been our privilege to call on him when practical experience and his gift of candid speech are at a premium. I asked him to make meaning of the awful news out of Paris.
Well, I think the first thing it means is that those who argued that Daesh, as I prefer to call it, was a purely local or regional phenomenon and could be contained were wrong.
Who said that?
Quite a number of scholars and think tank people in Washington, as well as elsewhere, seem to think that Daesh was a purely local or regional phenomenon with aspirations only to control societies in the Middle East. It never was that. It always had as an agenda reprisal for Western humiliation of the region's Muslims and for the death of many people from Western intervention. And it has now demonstrated that, not just against the French and the collective West, if you will, but against the Russians in Sinai, against the Chinese, because there are now numerous people from China fighting with Daesh, and there have been incidents in China in which Daesh claims complicity.
But is Daesh up to that sort of ambition?
Daesh is flourishing in an atmosphere of great resentment on the part of many of the world's Muslims, a sufficient number that a fringe will join its fanatical cause. They're not really religious. Mostly they are disgruntled, humiliated, alienated youth who find the adventure and the notoriety of Daesh appealing.
In rough but essential terms, how like, how unlike Al-Qaeda of 2001?
Well, Al-Qaeda was and remains a movement which has no territory. It is a network of individuals, many of them spontaneously joining it. It does have a central authority which tries to guide its activities, its attacks on people. But Daesh, from the beginning, aspired to build a caliphate, a state, and to expand that caliphate or that state to at least the borders of the historical Arab Empire.
How like, unlike is President Hollande's response with military action from President Bush?
Well, essentially, it's the same. It's an effort to solve a political problem by purely military means. It is, in effect, consistent with the classic definition of insanity, doing the same thing again and again and expecting it to yield different results. It is, in fact, the overweighting of military means to the point of almost excluding diplomacy that has led to the reprisals that Daesh has just carried out, and indeed that Al-Qaeda carried out in 2001.
In hindsight, so many people came to see the attack on the World Trade Center, 9/11, as blowback from our engagement with the Mujahideen and Osama bin Laden himself in Afghanistan. I mean, can this be called blowback?
Well, this is definitely blowback from a century of Western interference, intervention, and frankly, a large-scale murder and tailored assassination or the elimination of individuals in a widening area of the Middle East. The danger is that, and we can see this already in the reactions to Paris, that we will once again go into denial and treat this as a bolt from the blue, reflecting an irrational hatred of our values rather than a retaliation for things that we have been doing and continue to do. President Hollande's approach, bombing more, which Mr. Putin has also adopted, is a guaranteed means of producing counter-escalation by Daesh and those who sympathize with it. It will not solve the problem.
I'm not sure I get it. What was Daesh responding to from the French when it attacked Paris on the 13th?
Everything from the French imposition of the borders under Sykes-Picot after World War I to the French intervention in Syria more recently. The French have been bombing Syria. They have been bombing Daesh. Daesh is now struck back. There is a sad reality in the world that with the disappearance of the bipolar order between the United States and the Soviet Union, there is no one to restrain those whom you bomb from bombing back. And if you bomb foreigners, even if they don't have aircraft with which to respond, they will find another way to deliver a bomb, and that is exactly what just happened.
Ambassador Freeman, this gets very, very dark and also so huge as to be almost unmanageable. Just to think about it, you're talking about 100 years, blowback for 100 years of Western power. For Sykes-Picot, I suppose you'd have to include the French record in Algeria, too, and the injustices and the humiliation of Arabs in North Africa. Can it possibly be that large? And how in the world would you respond to it if it is?
First of all, it's not directed at France so much as at the West in general, because we are all complicit. After all, the United States pretty much unilaterally started the destabilization of the Fertile Crescent with our intervention in Iraq, which, by the way, followed the imposition of sanctions and, by UN estimate, resulted in the death of at least 500,000 children below the age of five. So there's a lot of reason for resentment of the West in the region, and those chickens, in a sense, are coming home to roost. But Daesh is a very complex phenomenon, and I think it is not just blowback to Western intervention. It is also part of an argument, a dispute, perhaps even a sort of 30 years war within Islam, between different tendencies in Islam, and it represents the violent reaction to the Western intrusion in the region that the Crusades, in effect, represented to the Islamic or Arab intrusion into Europe 1,000 years ago. So what we have here is something very deep-rooted and can't be dealt with without two things happening. First, the theology, the distorted, perverted theology of Daesh has to be addressed, and it has to be addressed by Muslims, which means that we need allies in the region. And we have allies in the region if we choose to engage them. And second, we do need to deal with Daesh militarily. And I think it is remarkable that at a moment when virtually every country, not just in the region but beyond it, shares an interest in containing and crushing Daesh, that there is no effort being made, apparently, to engage the United Nations Security Council. Hmm. China has a problem. Russia has a problem. Britain and France have a problem. Other great powers like Germany have a problem.
Iran has a problem.
Iran has a problem. Turkey has a problem. Saudi Arabia has a problem. And it should be possible, and it wouldn't be a bad idea, to return to the rule of law internationally by invoking the United Nations to create a grand coalition in which there would be a division of labor between the partners dealing with the theology and to some extent offering troops on the ground and Russian and Chinese support in the form of intelligence and weapons, materiel, and political rallying of the international community. That's within our grasp, and yet I hear no one talking about it.
But that must be explained. Why in the world? You know the bad habits and good of governments, grand alliances. Why isn't that happening? The big rethink.
Well, one reason, of course, is that in the post-Cold War era, the United States has walked away from the United Nations. The first Gulf War was conducted under UN auspices very successfully. Since then, all of the interventions that we've seen, whether they were in Bosnia or in Kosovo, or in Iraq, or in Syria, or in Yemen at the moment, have been conducted outside the framework of the UN Charter, and in fact, in gross disregard and violation of it.
Whose idea was that?
It's been an American idea. I should say it started with Bill Clinton, who couldn't get authorization to do things in the Balkans because of Russian opposition at the UN, and so went ahead unilaterally with a NATO a la carte arrangement. But it continued with George Bush II and the Iraq invasion.
Former Ambassador Chaz Freeman is our guest. Coming up, could there be a productive difference between prosecuting a criminal case instead of a war against ISIS? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Layden. This is Open Source. In the Paris aftermath, Chaz Freeman is our guest, known in the upper reaches of the U.S. security establishment for jargon-free insight spoken freely, even when it costs him and stings the rest of us. I asked him about President Hollande's promise of a pitiless war on what he called the terrorist army of Daesh. Alternatively, what about a massive criminal prosecution on the RICO model used against the mafia that would target not only ISIS, but its financiers and accessories before and after the fact, all to be settled in a court of law?
I think you've put your finger on an important point, and that is that treating criminal acts like terrorism as anything other than criminal acts, it's a mistake. And again, appealing to a broad international coalition, I think there is a consensus that could be materialized and realized in the form of the passage of legislation in individual countries and the adoption of an international convention that would authorize the treatment of this sort of activity, much as we used to treat piracy, that is, as a crime. Of course, getting rid of piracy involved military action, but it also involved criminalizing the behavior and prosecuting or bringing to justice those who engaged in it. And I don't think there's any disagreement whatsoever about that principle between the core countries of the region, Saudi Arabia and others, and those of the West, ourselves and our European partners, or even the Russians.
Juan Cole has been striking that note since Paris, that Daesh basically represents pirates in the desert. They're marauders, they're out for the cash, but they're not anything like a state, and we should be treating them as thieves.
Well, they do have a state, and to deny that is to deny an important reality. They now govern more people than most countries in the Middle East contain, more people than Jordan or Israel, a wider territory. They occupy and govern an area the size of the United Kingdom. Hmm. So this is not the classic non-state actor situation, although there are elements of that there. They also have many more recruits than they're able to induct or train. And their base of recruitment is multinational. It's not limited to the smashed states of Iraq and Syria. So I think we need to perhaps redefine this issue as 80% political, but it remains 20% military.
Would a criminal prosecution be able to flush out the Saudi and other sort of Gulf oil money, private and public, that's feeding the jihad?
Well, I think that there are vigorous efforts at enforcement by the Gulf Arab states, and that's not the major factor. You know, Daesh has got $2 billion in the bank. It produces oil. It sells the oil on the black market, so it's at a hefty discount. And it is, therefore, now very much self-sufficient. In Afghanistan, Daesh has been able to subsidize the elements who have joined it with salaries of $700 a month, whereas the Afghan National Army gets about $300 a month. So there are people joining this organization and this metastasizing, cancerous growth on the region, not for religious reasons, but for financial reasons.
Ambassador Freeman, you were ambassador to Saudi Arabia. You know the Saudi story all too well. Explain the point that everywhere people look now, they find Saudi money, Saudi influence behind the Wahhabi, puritanical theocrats that are feeding the fight.
Well, I think that the Saudis do bear a large measure of responsibility for having propagated a version of Islam, a very Calvinistic, very Protestant version of Islam, which provides a doctrinal basis for intolerance. And intolerance is at the root of Daesh's growth. It is the mirror image of Islamophobia in the West. And the Saudis do bear responsibility for this. But I think people who, as you say, find evidence of Saudi individual or the Saudi state everywhere they look are finding what they expect to find rather than what is really there. In many respects, the Saudis are themselves now the victims of blowback. And in many respects, they have lost control of the narrative that they themselves helped to create. And I think that they recognize that. Certainly the late King Abdullah recognized it. And there's no reason to believe that his successor, King Salman, does not also recognize it. So there has been an opportunity, which we have missed, to enlist the Saudis precisely because of their affinities with this deviant version of their theology to refute that ideology.
Sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. I mean, who's sorry now and what can they do about it?
Well, they have done a great deal within their own precincts. They have policed up the mosques, removed imams, preachers who were preaching a gospel of violence, reformed their educational curriculum, spent a huge amount of effort trying to educate the public about the perversion of Islam that Daesh's ideology represents. They have an effective reform process for those who have embraced Daesh's philosophy, a very low recidivism rate, not perfect, but much better than anyone else has developed. And finally, they've been ruthless in using force, law enforcement, police, to kill anyone who has taken up the gun and pursued a course of terrorism. So they have a three-tiered approach on their own territory. What we need to do is find a way to work with them to extend that internationally.
That is former Ambassador Chaz Freeman. We'll be back to him, but it's a pleasure at intermission, so to speak, to introduce a French journalist of stature. Sylvain Sipel was many years an editor at the French daily Le Monde. He was their correspondent from the Middle East, also from New York. He's the author also of the hardcover Walled, subtitled Israeli Society at an Impasse, published in 2006. Our sympathies first to France and to Paris, Monsieur Sipel.
Thank you.
So much news unfolding here. Just in your President Hollande's itinerary for next week, Washington first, and then Moscow. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells that he needs allies, And he's changing completely his previous policy towards the Middle East. He had a policy he refused to bomb in Syria.
Hmm.
And he was bombing ISIS in Iraq, but he refused to bomb Syria. And the explanation he gave when he was asked why he refused is that he didn't want to help either Assad nor Daesh. It meant that he has two enemies in Syria. This is over. He has one enemy in Syria, which is ISIS. And this was the position of Putin from the start.
Yes.
Now, it was not the position of Obama. Now, he's coming to meet Obama and to meet Putin, and he is very rapidly evolving toward a position of a great coalition.
Yes.
And then what is the content of a great coalition and the political content of a great coalition is absolutely not clear. But he is today in the war against terror. He's again, after George Bush, he's going on that path. He's going exactly on the path that Chase Freeman said that is going nowhere, is going to be a failure.
Well, he's going in the direction of a grand alliance that Chaz Freeman was appealing for.
Yes,
a more inclusive strategy, a military one.
The only thing that Hollande is speaking about since the bombing in Paris is only how to win militarily, ISIS. And Chaz Freeman was very right to answer that the fight or the war on ISIS will not pass through a military victory. But the question is political.
But is not Hollande's hawkishness being tempered by Putin and the Russian interest? The Russians have not been for a big military intervention.
The Russians are interested in maintaining Assad in power.
Yes.
This is another topic. When you build such a great coalition, you need to know exactly each part has to make some concessions. But what is the basis of that coalition? And this is absolutely not clear, because obviously between Obama and Putin and even Hollande in the middle, there are different ways to and different ambitions here. It is obvious, for example, that the Iranis and Putin, they want first of all maintain Assad in power.
Yes,
it's obvious that this is not what Obama and Hollande want.
Yes, but certainly to embrace Putin at this point is to retreat somewhat from a unilateral or purely French or purely revenge military strike, right?
No, I don't think so, because this is exactly what Putin will want to do too, because he had his own problem with that plane. He didn't want to recognize that wasn't, you know, what happened in Sinai 10 days ago or 2 weeks ago?
Yes.
When ISIS bombed a Russian plane.
Yes.
Okay, so it was a big problem for Putin to recognize that it was ISIS that did that, because it meant, in front of the public opinion in Russia, that this is because Putin bombed militarily ISIS in Syria. Exactly as up to now, Hollande has not said a single word about the fact that what happened in Paris came 3 weeks after he decided to bomb ISIS in Syria.
Speak of what came to be called the ornithological miracle during the Balkan crisis, describes the transformation of hawks into doves and doves into hawks. The sudden shift now between officials in the U.S. and France is striking. The government of Chirac in Villepin after 9/11 was insistently dovish with respect to George Bush's war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But now Hollande and France are hawkish, and Washington, certainly the Obama White House,
right,
have been resisting. I mean, make sense of this, and where is it going? What's the?
I understand your question. It's a hard question. I can just. It's obvious that today Hollande behave, and people are starting to say that in France, some people at least. Hollande is starting to behave exactly as Bush behaved the day after 9/11.
Yes.
The speech is very similar. I'll give you an example. Why did he gave that definition of ISIS as a terrorist army?
Yes.
A terrorist army, it doesn't exist nowhere in the laws about war. No one knows what is a terrorist army. So it reminds something. It's the invention of a concept, a terrorist army. First of all, it's very false. It's not a terrorist army. It is, as Chas Freeman said also, it is an organization, a political organization, that uses military means for terrorism and terrible terrorism. But this is something very different. It's not simply an army. But why to choose a definition that doesn't exist in the war law? It reminds very much, you know, the enemy combatant. Because when you have a new
the neologisms of the Bush administration, but has he forgotten the lessons of...
Oh, Hollande, he seems to have very much forgotten that lesson. Yes, I would answer yes. And this is a big difference with Chirac and Villepin. Villepin has written an article in France very recently that was strongly against the path of Hollande.
But I wonder, is the French public catching on to Hollande's militancy, and is Hollande listening, you know, with a little patience after a week, to the wisdom that France embodied in Iraq? But let me ask you a different question that Chas Freeman raises, which I find fascinating, of a sort of gap in memory. He speaks of a 100-year grievance in the Arab-Muslim mind from Sykes-Picot at the end of World War One, which ended up in British and French imperial mandates in the Middle East, as of course you know. There have been many wounds and many revenges and counter-revenges since then, back and forth, remembered in opposite ways, including 9/11 and the Iraq War. Question, does France or the United States or the West in general have its own 100-year memory together in its head to work with toward a different future?
I'll speak about France because
please
about America or Germany.
You are France in this studio.
Yes, yeah.
Please.
Now, France. It's very interesting. It's a very interesting question because France has, as we say, it's the only country in the world that has some what we call a guilty memory, both toward Jews and toward Arabs. Jews because of the Holocaust that exist also in France. One-third of French Jewry was exterminated with French complicity. And they have also a guilt memory about Arabs because of the war in Algeria, which was a terrible war. Hundreds of thousands of Arabs died in that war. Mm. Okay, it was a good war for independence. Okay, now, what happened since then is that it took a lot of time, but the French did the job with the question of the Holocaust. It was hard. It was not very quick. It took a lot of time.
The job
was painful. But at the end of the day, they recognized the part of France in what happened. They never did that job with colonialism and what happened in the Algerian War. Mm. It's still something like, you know, we don't want to sing. There are more and more books about that, and there were some movies, but politically speaking, it remained a very touchy question. Hmm. It's a problem now with the Arabs, and particularly with the Sunnis, because the Arabs in Algeria are all Sunnis and Iraqi, and ISIS is a Sunni organization.
Yes.
Now, I think it's a real problem. I think the fact that there was no balance sheet about what our history with the, well, I wouldn't say that there was no balance sheet. There was no enough balance sheet on that topic in France.
question is, how does that guilt, if it is guilt, or self-consciousness, or awareness of historical burden, affect this moment?
Yes, this moment is affected in a terrible way, because today you assist to a writhing phenomenon in France, which is more and more xenophobia and more racism toward Arabs and Muslims. Now, when this bombing comes, it's extremely dangerous, because what ISIS want to do is to demonstrate to French Arabs that they have no place in France. And if this is pushing France to be more racist, to be more xenophobic toward Muslims, it will be a problem, including a big problem in France, because my forecast is that if this happens, I hope very much it will not, but if this happens, you will find more and more young Arabs that will go, that will decide to go to ISIS.
But surely that identification with racism or xenophobia is not what François Hollande stands for.
Well,
or
he
wants
says
to
he
stand
doesn't
for.
Want. He doesn't want. But this is what the way he behaved. This is the risk that is included in the way he behaved.
This is fascinating. Coming up, more on the refugee crisis, the long view of constitutional values, and the who are we questions in Europe and in the United States. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a seminar, this time with Chaz Freeman, known for distinguished service to the U.S. government, East and West, and also for keeping his own mind clear and free. He was first invited by the Obama administration and then blocked for service at the top of the National Intelligence Council. Here he was last year, out of government, speaking bluntly about policy in the Middle East.
A while back, the United States set out to reconfigure the Middle East. And the result is that the region and our position in it are both in shambles. We've answered the end of the bipolar Cold War order with a mixture of denial, strategic incoherence, and inconstancy. We can and should do better than this.
Chaz Freeman, can I say your voice fascinates me and the spectacular career behind it. You were the superstar foreign service officer of your generation. You translated from Mao and Richard Nixon in Beijing in 1972. You've had a career all over the world. You're multilingual. You're universally respected among the experts. President Obama wanted you as his sifter and sorter of intelligence estimates. I keep wondering, what is the president missing for want of your having that job? Everybody knows you were vetoed by friends of Israel, especially AIPAC, but what is the world missing?
Well, I always remember the comment of Charles de Gaulle, who said that the cemeteries are full of indispensable men. And I don't consider myself in any respect indispensable.
No, but just wise and outspoken, that'll do.
Thank you. And by the way, I did not interpret for Mao because of the paranoia of President Nixon, who did not want any American there who might subsequently leak to the press, which I've never done, by the way.
Were you not there with Zhou Enlai and Henry Kissinger?
Zhou Enlai is a different matter. Yes, I got to know him quite well.
Okay.
I think the issue is a systemic failure, and it goes back to a whole series of problems in our country. We have a dysfunctional government. We can't carry on a civil dialogue across partisan lines. We can't even pass a budget, which means we can't set priorities domestically. Therefore, it's unrealistic to expect us to set priorities internationally. We're far too comfortable dealing with the world as we would prefer it to be than as it is. And we have a leadership, and I'm not singling out anyone in particular, but speaking across the board, which prefers to tell us what we want to hear, rather than challenge us to recognize the unpalatable realities that we ourselves in part have helped to create. So leadership, part of it, consists of educating the public and helping the public to understand why a bit of sacrifice is necessary to resolve problems, We have none of that. In the case of George Bush the younger, the invasion of Iraq was followed not by a demand for sacrifice and solidarity, but by a suggestion that we all go shopping.
So, sum it up. What is it that we have to learn about our superpower role, about leading, as we fancy, the world economy, certainly being the hyperpower militarily? What are short things we've got to learn about managing this empire?
Well, the basic equation is this. If we can't get our act together at home, we're not going to be able to lead abroad. And the world that we're now entering, that we have entered, in effect, is not one in which we are the sole superpower or the hegemonic leader. It is one in which there are many countries in their own regions and with their own agendas. And we're going to have to work at it if we're going to get the international cooperation we need to deal with the problems that we and others have. And that goes back to the point I made earlier, that we can no longer afford to ostracize people or nations because we have arguments with them. We have arguments with everyone. Western Europeans have been arresting CIA officers because of their habit of kidnapping and torturing people. We are no longer the admired exemplar of human rights that we once were, and we have, in many respects, both domestically and internationally, turned away from the rule of law. So I think we should begin by reaffirming the values of the Atlantic civilization, which are the rule of law and human rights. We should insist that our response to Daesh and others who espouse other values is not to adopt their values, a mindless violence, but to reaffirm our own. It is not worthwhile to try to save the values of the United States by destroying them.
People seem to wonder, is this the new order, something we have to get used to, this kind of terrorist attack, or is it something we can eradicate? Putting security first, we got to do something to stop it.
Well, first, it took decades to brew up this situation, and it's going to take a long time to deal with it. We're going to have to be patient. Second, we should not overestimate the risks. It's not possible to have absolute security. And if you seek absolute security, you will drive yourself crazy because you can never achieve it. And we must accept that there is a certain level of risk in existing in the world, including internationally. So we shouldn't panic. And here we need to demand of our leaders, the politicians, that they not aid and abet panic or try to exploit it to strike politically appealing stances, but that they help us to understand the challenges that we face and to meet them. And I don't see that happening, frankly.
Is there anything Paris or Washington could do in the next month to change direction that would put a smile on your face?
Yes. I think they could go to the UN Security Council and try to expand the international consensus into a legal framework and a coalition focused on the containment and destruction of ISIS, Daesh. And I think that is within reach. And while the United States cannot be out front in this, because if we were out front, we would aggravate the problem by appearing to confirm Daesh's thesis of our aggressiveness and anti-Islamic mindset, while we can't be out front, we can certainly be a major part of the coalition, and we need to demand in this context that our Arab Muslim friends stand up and be counted.
Which ones in particular?
Saudi Arabia carries a particular responsibility, not only because of its past propagation of its theology, which is congenial to ISIS, or Daesh, but also because it is the custodian of the Muslim holy places, Mecca and Medina, and the world looks to Saudi Arabia for leadership.
If it is a 100-year problem, and if it does go back to the notoriously arrogant Western Sykes-Picot remapping of the new states coming out of the Ottoman Empire, what should we do about that? I mean, can you imagine a 2, 3, 10-year project of the United Nations to rethink the shape of the Middle East in its people's terms?
Well, I think you can't rewrite history. It happened. What you can do is demonstrate that you've changed. And both sides need to do that. We need to begin that with a change on our own side. It's not up to us to determine the shape of the Middle East. That is something that the people who live there have the right and responsibility to do. We have seen in the last 15 years the disintegration of the state of Iraq under the impact of our invasion and occupation, the kindling of sectarian warfare in the Fertile Crescent, the resulting destabilization and finally disintegration of Syria, and we now have the knock-on effect of the European Union, the EU, being destabilized by refugee flows it doesn't know how to handle. And I think we need to pause and reflect about what is all this for? What are we trying to preserve? What are we fighting for? And then conduct the fight on that basis, not on ISIS's terms.
That is former Ambassador Chaz Freeman, and he's not quite finished. But back to Sylvain Sipel, who, the writer and editor at the newspaper Le Monde in years past. Sylvain, pick up some of those Chaz Freeman themes in European terms about the burden of history, which will not be rewritten, but the changed thinking that can be demonstrated. Also, the threat to European values, including yes. civil liberties, but also the free passage across national borders, a central idea in the new Europe. Plunge
I'll
in.
Tell you, there is one phrase of, I quote, maybe not exactly, but Chaz Freeman said something. He said, "We shouldn't panic nor exploit panic." I think it's extremely important, and I think, unfortunately, Hollande does exactly the opposite. Mm. I mean, what he did since the bombing, he showed muscles. Instead of coming to the people and saying that simple phrase, "We shouldn't panic and we shouldn't lose our values." What are our values? If we lose our mm-hmm. values, this will be a victory for Daesh. He didn't say that. He went to the parliament, he went to the Congress, the French Congress, and he asked for more extraordinary means for the government. For example, state of emergency now in France, it is for 12 days. Mm-hmm. So he asked that it will be for 3 months. State of emergency, the presidency can act without out of control of the parliament, of the legislature. So this is a terrible error, starting by forgetting what is the basis of an open democracy. It goes with the idea that the fight against ISIS is only a military fight. He never speaks about politics.
What is speaking here? Is this his heart? Is it his expert advisors?
I'm not.
Is it his Pentagon, so to speak, or is it the people on the street? What are plain people saying?
I'll tell you. I hope I'm wrong. But I suspect that what motivates him is only politics, French politics. He has
meaning himself,
elections.
His party,
yes.
His new election.
His party, his re-election. He thinks, and it's a mistake. He's mistaken, but he thinks. First of all, he has elections in 3 weeks, regional elections. It's very important not to lose them for him, at least not to lose too much, because everybody in France forecasts that he's going to lose. His party is going to lose. No, now, he thinks that in such a situation, he has to show himself, to present himself to the opinion as a leader, a commander-in-chief.
But remember, I mean, he surely has not forgotten that George Bush won re-election and is nonetheless disgraced. Tony Blair is disgraced by Britain's performance in the war in Iraq.
Unfortunately,
I mean, what is this caution?
Most politicians don't behave with that kind of memory. They just think about tomorrow. and they think they need not to lose too much in the next 10 days. It's too hard to come to the French opinion and to say, listen, wait, wait, and start thinking what exactly to do, and don't rush, don't rush. Behave intelligently, and don't forget our values. It's too hard today.
But he's coming not to the just to the French provinces next week. He's coming to the world. He's coming to the United States and then to Russia.
Yes.
What does that? How does that temper him or change?
Well, let's say that it will. It well. First of all, I think that. Again, Chase Freeman said something very interesting about the possibility to go to the Security Council.
Yes.
Yes. It seems that if this is the way to have to build that great coalition, he needs to have that discussion with Obama and with Putin. He will not go there without the conviction that being convinced that he has an agreement with both with Putin and with Obama on that. So there will be a debate before they will act. Now they are just bombing. But if they want really an international broad coalition, of course it would be much more interesting to go to the
Security Council. We've spoken too little of the refugees, and we won't have time to get into it deeply. But yes or no, are open borders within Europe at risk here?
They are, unfortunately. They are very much. And if it is true, for example, then what one of the terrorists in the bombing in Paris came from Syria together with the refugees. He entered in Serbia together. If this is true, which is not proven, but if this is true, the far right in France will have the occasion to say not a single refugee anymore in France.
For our last words, we turn again to Ambassador Chaz Freeman. I asked him about the years ahead, how the terror threat and the cycle of violence could diminish us or, maybe at the worst, overwhelm us.
I don't think this is at all threatening to our existence. The only threat to our existence is our own willingness to sacrifice our values out of panic. This really is a case where, as Roosevelt once said in a different context, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself and what it forces us to do and to give up. I don't agree that this is an existential struggle, but it's a damn difficult one. And we could easily find ourselves, as the British did for several generations, suffering from terrorism. In their case, it was the Irish. And I suspect that many listeners would agree that the Irish had real grudges, even though they might not agree that blowing up buildings and people in London was the appropriate way to draw attention to them. So we may face a prolonged period in which we're going to have to tolerate a higher level of risk. But I don't think the British gave up their liberties, even though they were struggling with the IRA. And we should not give up our liberties, whether it's habeas corpus or the right not to be searched without a warrant, or the right to confront an accuser and to know the charges against ourselves if we are detained. We should not give up these rights, and we should not allow our Constitution, which reserves the power to authorize war to the Congress, to be usurped by the executive, allowing the Congress to evade responsibility. We have to return to constitutional practices. Whatever happens, whatever we do in response to Paris, it should not be left to President Obama to make the decision on his own, while the members of Congress stand aside and carp at whatever it is he decides. We need a measure of national unity to deal with this question.
Thank you, Ambassador Chaz Freeman. Thanks also to Sylvain Sipel and Judith Gurevich. There's more on our website, radioopensource.org. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Pat Tomino, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next week on Open Source.